From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the pages of a new book by Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse. The book is called The Vanishing American Adult, and in it, Sasse argues for a kind of throwback approach to parenting. He thinks kids are generally too soft these days, unable to handle adversity, overwhelmed by the transition to adulthood. And one of Senator Sasse's recommendations is that parents make sure kids are exposed to travel. He believes travel can offer great experiences, but he is not talking about Disney World or typical tourist fun stuff. He's talking about cultural immersion, spending a lot of time in other places, seeing other sides of humanity. And in the book, Sasse writes, quote, "Tourism, not travel, is the default mode of travel in our culture of cheap amusements. My guess is that for most of us, our kids show up on day one of any trip we take as a family, having done little more than show up," end quote. So this hour, a conversation about travel, the value of travel, the ways to travel that allow us to experience the world beyond tourist trappings. We have the chance to sit down with perhaps the most well-traveled man in Rochester, and that's Paul Burgett, University of Rochester Vice President and Senior Advisor to the President of the University. Are you the most well-traveled man in Rochester?
Probably one of them. I think my spouse and I are probably two.
How many trips a year?
We take two a year abroad, and my spouse takes a third now that she's retired from teaching. She goes a third time someplace in the world, and we've been doing this for 36 years, starting when we were young assistant professors at Nazareth College, and young didn't have a whole lot of money, but decided that it was something we wanted to do. So, Evan, We as soon as the school year was over, we hopped on a plane and went to London, Paris, Rome, Florence, Venice, Lucerne, and Vienna in that month. And on the way back, we're talking about how wonderful that experience was and decided, let's go next year. The rest is history. We've gone every year since then and visited with meaningful travel 60 countries on 6 continents. Antarctica awaits us and may yet until my next life.
What's the longest you've stayed in one place?
Typically, we travel for a month. Now we go for 5 or 6 weeks. And my spouse, who has itchier feet than I do, I jokingly say that she would be probably content stopping in Rochester a couple of times a year to be sure I was still breathing. But we go for 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks. That's the big trip. And then between Christmas and New Year's, we take about 10 days to go. So, for example, this holiday season, we're going to Guatemala. And then February and early March, we will go to the Caribbean. We'll go to Jamaica, St. Lucia, Nevis. And I'll be gone for about 5 weeks, and she'll be gone for about 8.
And I know, to some listeners, this is already starting to sound like a conversation about privilege. And in some ways it is. But I also know that we're going to talk this hour about the value of travel and, you know, trying to make sure that, you know, to the extent that we can, everyone's got different resources, to the extent we can, understanding the value and the possible impact. Fair enough, Paul?
Absolutely. That's quite right. I mean, we have deliberately chosen to live a simpler life in Rochester so that we can allocate resources to this very important part of our lives. It has been a bonding experience. It has been a growing experience. And because both of us are academics who work with people from all over the world, it's really been part of our education.
Also here is Jane Gatewood, the University of Rochester Vice Provost for Global Engagement. And I'm just going to go ahead and can I read your entire resume here? Because this is, I told Paul when he walked in, I said, Jane's resume might be the most impressive I've ever heard. First of all, you're in a bachelor's degree from Emory University, PhD from the University of Georgia, yes?
Yes.
Administrative experience includes developing complex bi- and multilateral international partnerships for research, education, mobility, and economic development. You spent the last decade working at the intersection of business, higher ed, government, and diplomatic relations. You were a Fulbright Scholar and a Andrew W. Mellon Fellow at the School of Advanced Study, the University of London. You were a visiting research assistant for the Oxford English Dictionary, which is so cool. I want to talk about that as well. Your academic training and expertise are in paleography, modern literary history, lexicography, and corpus linguistics, and you regularly consult and speak on the importance of partnerships to international higher ed. Is that all?
That's accurate.
Before we get to the travel thing, what did you do for the dictionary?
So I did a couple things. The on site in Oxford, I was editing American pronunciations, which, as we all know, are distinct from British pronunciations. And American pronunciations are more various and varied than British pronunciation, which has a British English has a received pronunciation, where they put out an official pronunciation through the OED.
What's an example of a word or a phrase that you can recall that it has that distinction?
The British English.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to the BBC. So the BBC English historically has been received pronunciation. It's going as they say the way of the dodo now because of linguistic variety. They recognize that it's much more various, but American pronunciation. So a lot of the P's in the third edition of the OED will have a southern U.S. slant to them, courtesy of yours truly.
But what's an example of a southern U.S. slant to it?
I just have longer vowels than a northeastern. I grew up in Georgia and Alabama, so my vowels will be a little bit longer.
You hang on the vowels longer.
Yep.
Okay. I always thought the difference between British spoken English and American spoken English is, number one, we turn T's into D's and S's into Z's. And
yep.
If we just kept T's as T's and S's as S's, we'd sound a lot more British.
Perhaps if you drop your R's too, because R's are very distinguishing characters. So you might notice that Brits will say banana.
Okay.
And they add an R,
yeah.
Right? And then if you say
good idea, yeah.
Yeah. If you say Holborn, H-O-L-B-O-R-N, we might say Holborn, put the R in, Brits will take it out.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so look, we could probably get hung up on language the entire hour with Jane, but we're here to talk about travel. I suppose that means, given your resume, you've traveled quite a bit. I don't know if you can quite state the resume the way Paul has thought about his own life travel, but how much travel have you done?
I've done a considerable amount of travel. I started traveling domestically when I was a child. I traveled with my parents throughout the U.S. And I should, going back to the question of privilege, I should say that we traveled because my father traveled for work. And so we traveled with him via car across the majority of the United States by the time I was probably 15. Contiguous United States. And then when I was in high school, I had the opportunity to do an educational exchange program with the Commonwealth of Independent States, the former Soviet Union. Went there, spent the summer between my junior and senior years of college traveling there and not being a tourist, learning. And that was, as they say, a transformative experience, and then spent part of college experience and after doing a lot. So I can't quantify the way Paul has where all I've traveled. I've not been to Antarctica either.
And but otherwise, it feels like we've got most other places covered between the two of you, it seems.
Pretty largely, probably.
Yeah, so what I want to do first is I want to listen to some sound of Ben Sass, and I want to also make something clear here. I mean, this is not an hour to lecture parents on how to raise kids, nor is it an hour to interrogate our guests on their thoughts on that. But I think what Senator Sass gave us was a jumping-off point in distinguishing between the kind of travel that is just recreational and the kind of travel that might have a real cultural impact on us, or our kids, but us as adults, too. And so this is Ben Sass talking to Bill Kristol about his book. And you'll hear him discuss a number of things, but they're going to get into travel as well. This is Senator Ben Sass.
We want them to have the eyes that come from new travel. And by that, I don't mean grand European tour, rich people travel. I mean, have been somewhere else to look back. I think about when I was a little kid, my dad and all of his coaching buddies would talk about how they went to Canada fishing every summer when they were in high school and then early in college. And living in a truly primitive place, they saw their hometown for the first time. They saw social relationships that they'd never seen before until they were in a place that had no built environment. You want to have those productive experiences. You want to have limited consumption. You need some intergenerational experiences. If you have a lot of things happening in your life when you're 12 and 14 and 16 and 18 that aren't just grade movement through school, that's a lot more interesting life. Then school also becomes more interesting because you can seize that tool for its purposes.
All right, Senator Ben Sasse, we'll start with you, Paul. What do you think?
I think that the travels that we have done coincide quite nicely with the aspiration that he just articulated. In the many years that Kay and I have traveled, and I should mention she's a sociologist, and as a sociologist brings the sociological perspective to our travels. And so we've been very interested, for example, in the expressions of race, expressions of gender, expressions of social class in many of the places that we have traveled. Just to give you a personal example, on that first trip that I mentioned, I was stopped by a man in Victoria Station in London, and he came up to me and he said, "May I ask you a question?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Are you Egyptian?" And I thought that was a curious question. I'd never been asked that before. And so we just let it pass. But later in the trip in Florence, Italy, by the Ponte Vecchio, there was a dark-complected woman who came running up to me at the bridge there, and she said in heavily accented English, "Excuse me, may I ask you a question?" I said, "Sure." She said, "Are you Egyptian?" And I thought, well, that's the second time on this one trip that I've been asked that question. I've never been asked a question like that. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, where I was identified as a Negro. That's how I understood myself. But the notion of being an Egyptian, I just had no point of reference with which to understand that. We decided to go to Egypt a few years later for our first trip to Egypt, got off the plane, went into the terminal to change some money. The money changer looked at me and he said, "American." And I said, "Yes." He said, because he knew I'd just gotten off this TWA flight, he says, "Welcome." He says, "But I tell you, my friend," he says, "you look Egyptian." Our entire trip in Egypt on that particular trip, that was 1984, and I remember it distinctly, was being perceived as something that I had, as someone I had never thought of myself as. That is to say that I was Egyptian, and the people simply took me in an unspoken way to be one of them, which stood in sharp juxtaposition to all of my experiences up to that point. Very quickly, fast forward to a trip in southern sub-Saharan Africa, where we were visiting in Kenya, and we went to a museum. We went to the museum in Nairobi, and there were school kids on their field trip there. And the two little girls came up to us and said, "May we practice our English with you?" And we said, "Sure." So we were just talking in English, and then they said, "May we touch you?" And we'd never been asked that question before, and we said, "Okay." And they said, "We like to touch the skin of white people." And I thought, oh, how curious that is. So they were perceiving me in a way that I'd never perceived myself. That very same trip, we were in the Masai Mara, and we were on a walking safari when some Tanzanian Masai men, we came upon some Tanzanian Masai men who were walking the Serengeti and the Masai Mara, and they were dressed in traditional clothing. They were armed with spears and knives. And so our guide, who was a white Zimbabwean, recognized these men and began a conversation with them. And all of a sudden, the white Zimbabwean guide burst out laughing, and he said, in their language, in their Kiswahili dialect, they call me Aloshampai. And Aloshampai, if I'm not sure I'm still saying that correctly, means white man. So I turned to these four Maasai warrior men, and I pointed to the guide, and I said, "Aloshampai, white man." And they nodded, yes. And then I pointed to myself, and I said, "No Aloshampai." And they looked puzzled. So I did it again, and they looked even more puzzled. So then I started I'm reminded of Jane and dialect and talk. So I thought, well, let me just talk a little bit to these brothers, so they know I am not no Aloshampai. And my spouse Kay looked at me. She said, "Fool, don't do that." and everybody burst out laughing. Well, suddenly I've gone from being a Negro or colored to being an Egyptian, to now being a white man. So the fiction of race became part of my lived experience because of this travel. Astonishing. If I hadn't done all of those things, if we had not made that kind of trip, I would not have that experience. I wouldn't have the the intellectual lived experience of the fiction of race, race as a constructed idea, not ethnicity. Ethnicity is something different, but race as a constructed idea, particularly as it gets played out in the United States.
And then what is the way to apply that kind of lesson? If everybody had felt what you felt in those moments and sort of were able to come back home and feel what you felt out of that, what do you think would change, Paul?
Well, I don't know. I still understand myself to be how I was socialized as a young person. I happen to be biracial, my mother Italian, my father African-American. Oh, and that leads to another very interesting part in all of this, because when people in parts of the world, especially darker parts of the world, would discover that I was not Egyptian, for example, I would get the question, who is your father? Who is your father? Now, that question really means, who are you? Where are you from? And I always had difficulty answering it until one day I came up with an answer, and it works perfectly. I would say, my father was African. Now, when you say that in that part of the world, that means sub-Saharan or Black Africa. So my father was African, my mother Italian. Think of the map. Italy, Africa, Egypt in the middle. And it works. I mean, people just simply understood. It's as Harry Belafonte sang in one of his songs, it was thick as mud, but it covered the ground.
And yet we get so hung up on race, don't we? And to you, you call it a fiction. Not ethnicity.
Not ethnicity. That's
race.
Something different.
But we get so hung up on it.
Right, exactly.
And we otherize people based on it.
Correct. I understood myself to be a Negro or colored, and by definition that meant something less than the majority culture, and that is something that I grew up with. I had to live with that, and that still resonates in part of me. But having had the experience that I've just described, and my own education, I've done a lot of reading, and I've had the benefit of a fine education. I intellectually understand it differently. However, I would point out that because I grew up in a segregated environment and before the 1964 Civil Rights Act, one had to be very careful about where one actually entered into a business establishment, for example, because I often would get the question when I'd go into a shopping place or a restaurant, I would get the question, what are you? Which I always found to be a peculiar question, but I knew what it meant. And so I would simply say, I'm a Negro, to which the person asking the question, the response immediately would be, we don't serve your kind here.
This is the 1960s.
This is the 1960s and late 1950s. That's right. And W.B. Du Bois has a wonderful, the wonderful intellectual W.B. Du Bois, one of the founders of the NAACP, has a wonderful story. He grew up in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. He has a wonderful story where he talks about the realization of him as somehow different from the rest of the kids in Great Barrington, who were mostly white. The despised population in Great Barrington were the Irish. And so something happened in which, to him, which I won't go into now because I'm not sure we have the time, but in which he says, the veil descended and I realized that I was once and henceforth ever different from the rest of them. Well, that is a common experience for people of color in the United States. It happened to me. And so this doesn't happen very much anymore, but still there's a chip in my brain that before going into an unfamiliar place, I still hesitate. There's something that where I want to hesitate, even though I know that I will. In fact, years and years ago, I would say to my spouse, you go in and see if it's okay for me to come into this place. So it's not entirely rational, but it's shaped by my socialization from an early age. So all of these experiences that I've described in Egypt, especially in Egypt, but it's happened in other places. I mean, in Morocco, I'd get the question, Egypt, no, Saudi, no, I'm an American, not possible. And my spouse, who is Italian, Sicilian, they decided in Morocco that she was a Berber woman from the High Atlas Mountains. And I joked that, and the Berber women in the High Atlas Mountains are tattooed on their faces. So I told her when we got back to Rochester, I was going to take her up to Lyle Avenue where there are tattoo parlors and see to it that she was really converted into a Berber woman. She promised to punish me if I ever did that.
She declined.
She declined.
Yeah. Jane, when you travel, you know, we were listening to Senator Sass talk about when, in his words, not just rich travel or travel for the wealthy, but travel to really experience. What do you, to the extent that you can travel for pleasure, I'm sure you've traveled a lot for work, mm-hmm. but when you travel for pleasure, what do you make of your goals of whether it's a week or more or even less of learning about a place, and how do you go about doing it?
So I read a lot initially, but let me tell you a preparation. Before I went to the Commonwealth of Independent States when I was in high school, and I would say that was somewhere between a work trip and a pleasure trip. It was distinctly pleasurable, but the objective was not overtly pleasure. I underwent, a couple weeks in advance of really learning about the place and learning about where I was part of a group, learning about where we were going. We learned about the historical context of the place. Via reading, we learned basic structures of language. And not only longer contextual history, but shorter, immediate newspapers and the like. So what is relevant to the population right now? What does the news look like in the places where you're going? Those are things that I think are useful and that I try to do even if I'm going for work or pleasure. I do travel a lot for work, and I often don't have time. I have an agreement with my spouse that I come back as quickly as possible, and I'm on the ground for as few nights as possible. But I think that it's useful, and I don't want to draw too hard a line between pleasurable travel and instructive or educational travel, because I actually think they're the same thing. I think, to me, travel is intensely enjoyable, even, you know, especially if I'm going to a place to learn or to work. But I think it part of that excitement is learning how do others engage with the world? How do others understand the world? How have they constructed their days? What stories do they tell? What are the basics of their language? And I am particularly interested in language, but I'm interested in language because I think it reflects a lot about a culture, how a culture is able to convey and communicate things, and the stories it tells you a lot about that culture. And you know, this is perhaps distilling it too finely, but culture really is shared narrative in a lot of ways. And I think one of the, maybe perhaps to bring it back to Sass's book and point, is that one of the challenges we have nationally is that we really don't have a shared culture as such, or rather, we are realizing that perhaps we never did, or we had a shared master culture, but we're realizing that it was much more fragmented than anyone wanted to realize, especially in thinking about Paul's recent story. I think that contending with those diverse narratives are really challenging, and we're all struggling with that in a lot of different ways. And so I do think travel is uniquely prepares people, and especially young people, for contending with difference and contending with discomfort, and for learning what is absolutely essential in life and the world. And honestly, there are, when you travel, you realize that you can get by with a pair of pants, a shirt, a little bit of food and water, and you can go anywhere, and that's really liberating.
Listeners, if you want to share your experiences, your thoughts on the value of travel for kids, do you think of travel the way Paul Burgett said earlier, where, you know, essentially you set aside a budget and you say, throughout the year when I'm home, I can sacrifice because the greatest parts of the year may be that kind of a trip. And are you like me? Is it hard to go back to a place that you have loved? Because you know if you do that, you deprive yourself of a chance to see something new. That's a hard thing. But anything you want to share, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'm just going to indulge myself one little story because this show is not about me, but I'm just going to do this, and then I'm going to turn it back to the guests for the rest of the hour because it's not about me. But, you know, I've done some wine writing, and sometimes people will say, oh, you know, did you go here or there? And they often mention sort of the bigger glamour places in Europe or the West Coast. And I like to go to these small towns and find the people doing the work that is much less heralded and sometimes countercultural, because I find we end up talking about wine, but we also talk about politics. We talk about daily life, the rhythm of where they are. And Bartolo Mascarello makes wine in the Piedmont in Italy. And in his office was a sign that said, no barrique, no Berlusconi. And barrique is a smaller French oak barrel, which is sort of controversial because the big American critics love it. It makes all international wine taste the same. And so Bartolo Mascarello was saying no to the big high wattage critics, and by the way, no Berlusconi either. And we ended up talking. You know, you end up talking politics. You end up talking much more about, you know, what is life like in the Italian countryside? How are you impacted by politics? It's very obviously very different in Rome to the countryside. But just those little moments where you get off the beaten path, I always find you get away from sort of sometimes what you're there for, and you talk about other things, and all of a sudden, to Jane's point, you end up learning so much about a person and what life is like in a community. How much language do you study before you go? How many languages can you speak, Jane?
I can only, right now, I'm very out of practice with the only other language that I could speak. So at a point, I could speak two. I could speak Russian and English. I can read some of a lot of Romance languages because I studied Latin.
And do you, before you travel, you dive into a little sort of last little refresher before you go?
I do. And I try to get, you know, what are the basics? How can you hail a taxi? Can you, you know, and our smartphones have made it a lot easier, in all honesty. But it is useful to know how to say hello to someone, how to count to 10, how to pay for something, how to ask how much something costs, greeting, thank you, and please are really, really helpful in any language. So you need to learn them, you know, before you go.
You know, English has so dominated the entire world that my one regret, if I have one, is that I'm not multilingual. I wish I were. I have studied as I've studied French and German. My mother is Italian, and that was her first language. By the way, I should tell you, when you mentioned Piedmont, that resonated with me because her family, the Garizios, are from the Piedmontese district. So, you know, you get some points from me for that. the English language dominates so much of the rest of the world. It sometimes is almost a little embarrassing because we should, in the United States, we really should be able to speak more than just English.
You talk about privilege, right?
Yeah.
I mean, English speaking, if that's your first language, that's a point of privilege for sure. I want to get our only break of the hour. And when we come back, I'll take some of your comments that have been coming in about travel and does travel strike a blow to bigotry? So one of our guests with that comment. So we'll hit that and some other comments and questions as well. Our guests are Paul Burgett, who is University of Rochester Vice President and Senior Advisor to the President, and Jane Gatewood is the University of Rochester Vice Provost for Global Engagement. Senator Ben Sasse's book was the jumping off point, but that was just a starting point. What's the real value of travel and immersing in other cultures? And now when we come back, let's hit that question about how do we break down otherism and how much can travel do that? That's next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, two of the last school districts to add full-day kindergarten in Monroe County are two of the highest ranked, Brighton and Pittsford. Now, Brighton is bringing full-day kindergarten. Pittsford still is not. We'll talk to superintendents from both districts about the community's thoughts on full-day K. Then in our second hour, it's the Summer of Food, another conversation. So we continue our discussions on food and ag. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. To the phones we go. This is Catherine from Marion. Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, hi. I'm a former teacher, too. I'm retired now, and I have to agree with the wonders of travel. I had very modest means, but every summer and many vacations, I was able to take my children camping, and camping out west means BLM and national parks, and just learning a whole different set of cultures. The Southwest culture is completely different from the Northeast, and just getting a sense of history. You know, we went to Acoma City, which has been in civilization for 2,000 years. You know, we never learned that here. We learned about the Pilgrims being the first people to come here. So you don't have to go to Europe and South America or any other place. You can just go to the United States and see completely different worlds. And it was just wonderful. Now both my adult children are travel crazy. So I guess I started something good.
Thank you, Catherine. I appreciate that. Thoughts, Paul?
Yeah, good for you. You know, there is the, I have in mind Duke Ellington's famous tune, Sophisticated Ladies. And he says that the inspiration for Sophisticated Ladies was that the school teachers, when school was out, they would hit the road, they would travel, and they would bring back to the classroom the experiences that they had as part of their travel. So I think we can put you in the category of not only a teacher, but a sophisticated lady.
Jane?
And I think the point that there are many different cultures within the U.S. is really an important one to learn. I think, you know, I'm not from the Northeast originally. I grew up in the American South, which a lot of people would say is another country entirely. Many times it's culturally distinct for sure. But my family wasn't Southern as such necessarily. And I spent a lot of time in the Northeast and Midwest and I think learned biculturally there as well. So it's a very good point.
All right, let me get a couple of our questions that have come in. One of our listeners asked, what would your guest say to someone who is lower income or even living in poverty and can't afford to travel? How can they create a similar experience or opportunity for themselves or for their kids? Let me follow that before I turn to our guest for an answer with an email that comes from Emily. Emily says, Evan, I've been very blessed to travel widely and agree that it is an extraordinary education and recreation. I served in the Peace Corps in Kenya, and a friend who was also a volunteer and first-generation immigrant from the Philippines and I agreed that we wished more Americans took advantage of that program. Living and working in another country is a beautiful gift, and the Peace Corps is a program that can help people from all economic backgrounds do it. That comes from Emily. So Emily offering some idea that, first of all, you know, volunteering in Peace Corps might be a way to travel. But, Paul, what else would you say to that question?
Yeah, you know, travel of any kind is important, whatever one's means might be. And so I would encourage anyone to travel the best they can with what they have. But I also would encourage them to look for opportunities which do exist that enable especially younger people, children, your children, for example, to take advantage of travel. School systems, for example, often will provide trips to various parts of the United States, but also trips abroad. And so I would encourage parents to look at what opportunities there are, to talk to the folks in their school about opportunities that may exist either in their school or in their community, in their city or in their county, because young people are traveling abroad more today than ever before, even when resources are so limited that trying to do it on one's own may be not possible. There are ways to make it happen, but one has to do some research into seeing what's out there and what's available. And I know that there are opportunities. Now, in addition, especially when one gets into high school, in college, we probably have 30% of our undergraduate population who spend a semester, or in some cases more, in a study abroad program. And oftentimes students who come from very limited means will say, I can't study abroad because I can't afford it. Well, in many colleges and universities, that's just not true, because their financial aid will support them in their ambition to travel abroad. So I think you want to do the research into what's possible and not begin with, oh, the sticker price is too high, it makes it impossible. It may be limited at first, but I think that there are opportunities. It just requires some digging and some research and networking with the people who have the information and can assist you and your sons and daughters to take advantage of those resources to do more travel.
Okay. Jane, anything you want to add there?
I just add that some local organizations that are internationally connected, like Rotary, often have scholarship programs and the like that can help. And, you know, When I went to the Commonwealth of Independent States, I was not from a economically privileged background, and I raised, with the help of my family, money. It was part of a program, and they gave us the entire apparatus to do the necessary fundraising to do it. So Paul is absolutely right. That was from the state government gave us the mechanism to do that.
Right. I couldn't agree with you more. Jane's mentioning Rotary. Rotary has an international program that mm-hmm. really makes it possible for people who otherwise might not have the opportunity to study abroad. And that's just not for college students or professional people. It's for pre-collegiate people as well. Remember that there is a battery of people whose business it is to assist people in identifying resources to have the experience of traveling both domestically and abroad. You just have to go after it.
All right, back to the phones we go. Nicole in Fairport. Go ahead, Nicole.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
Good.
I just wanted to call in. I love the topic of the day. Myself, I'm a family travel and special needs travel agent. I'm here locally in Rochester, New York, and I just think it's so important for our kids to travel. And I have three boys myself, two with special needs, and for my own family and for a lot of my clients who have children with special needs, travel can really be a source of therapy. Being exposed to different cultures, different places, it really opens up a world of just opening up their world. And for us, we've always seen our sons' language skills just blossom after we travel. We have so much more to talk about, so much more to share. And I really encourage even special needs families to really get out there and travel with their kids.
Nicole, do you get the sense that families who have special needs kids just find that, maybe assume that travel is too arduous? I mean, are you able to sort of shed some light on how that assumption might be wrong?
I think a lot of families with special needs don't travel. When my son was diagnosed with autism, we asked a lot of other families, you know, how do you do this? How do you travel? My husband and I were very avid travelers and wanted to continue going on vacations with our children. And we hit a wall with sensory meltdowns, behavior issues, and we didn't know how to proceed. And we asked a lot of other families, you know, how do you do it? And they said, you know, well, we don't. We don't travel. And I thought, God, that's so sad. So this is basically where my business came from, is, you know, learning how to find the accommodations in different destinations and for myself, and then share that with my clients to help them travel better and with less stress and anxiety.
Well, Nicole, thank you. It's a beautiful message, and I think an encouraging one, especially for everyone in our community to hear.
Evan, if I could just offer a comment. I'm so glad that this caller offered her perspective. The travel industry has become so much more sophisticated today than it was 36 years ago when we first started, and the accommodating all manner of abilities, not disabilities, but abilities, is now possible. I mean, there are not only for the children that our caller has mentioned, her children, but for much older or disabled people in wheelchairs. The industry has become far more sophisticated. And so limitations that heretofore might have simply ruled out traveling have just been systematically addressed.
Very good. One of our listeners, Joel, writes to us and calls us back to Monday on this program when we talked to a couple of students from Iraq who are here for about a month, a couple weeks in Rochester, as part of the Iraqi International Leadership Program. And those students talked about their assumptions of the United States. Their American counterparts talked about assumptions about Iraqis. And immediately they started talking about how fast those assumptions melt away when you travel or you actually have a conversation with someone from a different culture. And Joel writes to us and says, as we saw with the youth from Iraq, people have certain beliefs that are shattered by travel. I come back to Mark Twain's comments about travel striking a blow to bigotry. Jane, do you agree?
Absolutely. Again, to go back to, I went to Russia right after communism collapsed, and I myself was a child of the Cold War. I grew up, came of age in the 80s, where, you know, we were watching President Reagan say, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, there were a lot of assumptions that were part and parcel of just the cultural discourse in the U.S. and still are about the Soviet Union, about what communism is and about what it means. And traveling there at that particular time in the early 90s and being able to engage with peers, individuals who were my age, as well as members of the government and the like, obliterated my assumptions about what the Soviet Union was and was trying to be. Now, it was a challenging place, and the challenge it was the U.S. and the Soviet Union were in a detente, and that is always challenging, but. Again, to go back to the need for shared narrative, the way you get there is you meet people and you talk with them and you listen and you learn about them and you open yourself to the experience.
I mean, what surprised you the most, Jane?
That, you mean in Russia?
Mm-hmm.
I was expecting the people to perceive themselves as being deprived. And they were not and did not perceive that. You know, it was a tough time for that country economically. The ruble went from being worth 10 to 1 U.S. dollar, 10 rubles to 1 U.S. dollar when I arrived to, I believe, someone could check, and it was either 100 or 1,000 to 1, but the within 6 weeks, it shifted that much. It was a really tough time, and it made me realize the relevance of governance structures and how deeply they affect daily life in ways that we don't always understand overtly. And so I was very surprised that the people were warm and welcoming and hospitable and friendly, and they wanted to understand, they wanted to talk with Americans. We weren't dealing with the sort of Soviet spy that you know had been on TV. And
sure.
You know, I feel a little bit sheepish and childish saying that, in all honesty, but it's something I think about nearly daily, if not weekly, of just that it's very difficult to put in words the transformation that trip had on my understanding of the intersection of culture, politics, economics, and history.
Nationalistic identity.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Unfortunately, it's not as simple. I mean, it's more complex than the narratives we can draw up from afar, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It's infinitely complex, and you know, I think you mentioned you don't ever want to go back to the same place because you want to go somewhere new. I think it was Herodotus who says you can't jump in the same river twice. The place is always so. Even if I were to go back to Moscow now, it is absolutely not the same place.
That is a great rationalization. I'm going to use that. It's very good. Paul, what do you think about the idea of Twain's idea of travel as an antidote to bigotry?
You know, I'd like to piggyback on what Jane has just said. My spouse and I have had the privilege, and I use that word quite intentionally, to visit parts of the world that many people would see as a horrific, for example, the poverty in India, the poverty in black townships of Johannesburg and Cape Town. We were recently in Dharavi in Mumbai, which is probably the most well-known slum of some 200 slums in Mumbai. And we took a tour of the slum. And what was so interesting is we saw a kind of life there that most Americans have no idea about unless they've seen the movie Slumdog Millionaire, which was filmed there. But what was of particular note was the pride of the people in their home. This is their home. And the ways in which they structure their homes with a minimum of resources, but they're very proud of where they are or where they're living. It is their home after all. And so by walking through the very narrow walkways of Dharavi and meeting the people who were so pleased to see us and feeling melting away the socialized perspective, the xenophobic, socialized perspective about a place like this, made the whole trip so utterly valuable. Now, that is not to say that there aren't deep and abiding social issues there, problems there. They have some serious issues with healthcare and other sorts of things. But Dharavi, as an example, of the 200 slums, it's the only one, as I understand it, which has an industrial dimension to this township, where people are making things. If OSHA were to walk into this town, they would shut it all down. They would absolutely OSHA would shut the whole thing down, because that's what our perspective is. But the people who are there go about their lives every day, and I'm mindful of the cosmetics of culture, which is to say that every day around the world, people get up in the morning, they put on their pants and their shirt, they have something to eat, they go to school, they go to work, they go to church, they come home, they raise their children, and then they go to bed at night. I do the same thing in Rochester, New York. So there is... what is so important about visiting Dharavi or visiting some of the other places that we have been is having the preconceived notions about what this place is and, importantly, who these people are, which is almost always a negative perspective. Having that washed from my soul is really, really important.
Last couple of minutes, I want to ask both of you, what's high on your list and that you have not seen or spent time in? Paul?
Well, as I mentioned, we've not been to Antarctica, and I don't know that we will go to Antarctica.
Yeah, but come on. There has to be somewhere else.
In the most recent, our most recent travels, it is only in the last few years that we have spent time in South America and Central America. And so we have been doing more of that lately. We have not been to Alaska. I've always wanted to go to Alaska. So that's a place that's part of the United States, of course, but that I've wanted to visit. You know, having been in 60 countries and spent real time there, we are narrowing our focus a bit to identify places that we really haven't been. I've not been to Tibet, and I've not been to Nepal, and there are important things to consider about going there because of the altitude issues, but I would love to visit Tibet. I would love to see it. Whether my carcass can accommodate 12,000-foot altitude, I'm not so sure, but in my mind, it's a place that that I think I would like to go.
And any American cities you haven't been to that would love to go to?
If we think of North America broadly defined, I've never been to Vancouver, and I would very much like to go to Vancouver. Most of the other American cities I've been to multiple times.
Okay. Jane, country, and then an American city, perhaps.
So I really want to go to Peru. I've not been to Peru. I want to go to Machu Picchu and spend some time in the Andes. An American city, are we casting American
nets?
So I want to go to Quebec City. I'll go up to Canada as well. I've not been.
All right, very good. Paul, 30 seconds. Some closing thoughts from you. As we discuss the value of travel, what you would leave the audience with as they consider their next trip, their next, sometimes it's summer, but sometimes it's just something on the calendar to look forward to.
Indeed. And whether it's summer or some other time of the year, it doesn't matter. Fortunately, our year has 12 months, and depending upon your life circumstances, particularly for those who might be retired, February is a great month not to be in Rochester and to be in someplace warm, for those of us who don't put skis on. I would say that often people are busy getting around to it. All it requires is making the decision to go, making the arrangements, and you can do it all on the internet now, and hitting the send button. It's that easy.
Paul Burgett is the Vice President of the University of Rochester, Senior Advisor to the President, and perhaps the most well-traveled man in Rochester. Great having your experience. Thank you for being here, Paul.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Evan.
And Jane Gatewood has Rochester's most impressive resume. She is the University of Rochester Vice Provost for Global Engagement. Come back sometime and talk about some of the other things you do, will you?
I will do.
I had a great time. Thank you very much. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon. Talk to you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.